Every woman in England knew one simple rule: never embarrass a duke. Clara Ashford had a different rule: never let a duke embarrass you twice. She had walked through that iron gate with nothing but a worn leather bag, a letter of introduction no one had bothered to read, and a secret that could have brought the entire Wrentham estate to its knees. She chose not to use it, not yet. But the duke didn't know that. The duke didn't know anything about her, or so he believed. That was his first mistake. The carriage that brought Clara to Wrentham Manor belonged to a neighbor's coachman who had taken pity on her at the crossroads. She had not asked for a ride. She had simply been walking, spine straight, chin level, as though the mud on her boots was entirely beneath her notice, which, to be fair, it was. The manor rose from the morning mist like something out of a Gothic warning. Three stories of gray stone, ivy-strangled window frames and chimneys that exhaled thin white smoke into a sky the color of old pewter. It was not a welcoming house. It was not meant to be. The housekeeper, Mrs. Baird, met her at the servant's entrance, not the front door, a fact that Clara noted and filed away without expression. Miss Ashford, Mrs. Baird looked her over the way one examines a piece of furniture that has arrived slightly damaged. You're the new governess. I am. His Grace does not involve himself in the hiring of staff. You will meet the children at 7. Breakfast is at 6:30 in the kitchen with the rest of the household. Clara nodded once, and my room. The room was in the east wing, small and cold, with a window that overlooked the stables. The fireplace had not been lit. There were no candles on the writing table. The previous governess, Clara would later learn, had left without notice 3 weeks prior, and no one had thought to prepare for a replacement. She lit the fire herself. She unpacked her single bag with the efficiency of someone who had long ago stopped expecting comfort and started creating it. A hairbrush, 2 changes of dress, a small book of botanical illustrations her mother had given her, the only thing left from a life that no longer existed. She did not allow herself to think about that life for more than 30 seconds. Then she went to meet the children. Thomas was 9, serious-faced, and deeply suspicious of adults who smiled too quickly. Annabelle was 6, gap-toothed, and had apparently been terrorizing governesses since she learned to speak in full sentences. They were sitting at the schoolroom table when Clara arrived, both watching the door with the particular wariness of children who had been disappointed many times before. "You won't last a month," Thomas said, by way of introduction. "Probably not," Clara agreed, sitting across from them without ceremony. "But you'll learn something before I go. Now, which of you is better at geography?" Thomas blinked. Annabelle raised her hand. It was, Clara would think later, the only easy moment of that first day. She saw the Duke for the first time at 4:30 in the afternoon. She was crossing the main corridor with a stack of atlases when he came through the front door, still in his riding coat, mud-splattered and clearly in no mood for the world. He was taller than she had expected. Darker, too, black hair, sharp jaw, the kind of face that looked as though it had forgotten how to arrange itself into anything warmer than impatience. He did not look at her. He handed his gloves to the footman, said something low to his steward, and walked past her as though she were part of the wallpaper. Clara watched him go. Then she looked down at the atlases in her arms, and at the mud his boots had tracked across the floor she was standing on. On the corner of the corridor table, half tucked beneath a silver letter tray, was a document she should not have been able to see from that distance. But Clara had always had sharp eyes. The wax seal was broken. The letterhead, even upside down, even at 5 paces, was unmistakable. It was her father's crest. Her hands tightened on the atlases. Her face did not change. She turned and walked back to the schoolroom. What was her father's seal doing on the Duke's correspondence? And why did it look like it had been read more than once? Clara Ashford had come to Wrentham Manor to disappear. She was beginning to suspect that Wrentham Manor had been waiting for her all along. It started with a map. Clara had spent 3 days quietly establishing order in the schoolroom, a routine, a rhythm, a sense that learning could be something other than punishment. Thomas had stopped watching the door. Annabelle had started asking questions before Clara finished her sentences. Small victories, but real ones. On the fourth morning, she unrolled a map of the British Empire across the schoolroom table and asked the children to find India. Thomas pointed correctly, immediately. Annabelle said, "Is that where pepper comes from?" Clara said yes, and added that it was also where fortunes were made and lost, where the East India Company had rewritten the rules of trade, and where, at that very moment, thousands of people were living lives entirely different from anything the children could imagine from this gray corner of England. She did not hear the door open. "That is not the approved curriculum." The Duke's voice came from behind her, flat and certain, the voice of a man who had never once second-guessed himself in a room and did not intend to start now. Clara turned. He was standing in the doorway, no riding coat this time, just a dark morning coat, impeccably fitted, with the kind of posture that made the door frame look like a picture frame built specifically for him. He was looking at the map the way one looks at evidence of wrongdoing. "Your Grace," Clara did not step back from the table. The children were covering trade routes. The map seemed relevant. "The curriculum was written for a reason, Miss Ashford. History, mathematics, French, in that order. Thomas can already conjugate in French. Annabelle has memorized the kings and queens of England to a degree that I suspect would alarm most adults. They were ready to move forward." Something shifted in his expression, not softness, not quite, more like surprise that had been quickly suppressed. "I was not consulted." "Governesses rarely consult dukes, Your Grace. That is rather the arrangement." The silence that followed was the kind that had weight and temperature. Thomas had gone very still. Annabelle was looking between the two adults with the bright, dangerous attention of a child who understands more than she should. The Duke stepped into the room. He looked at the map. He looked at Clara. "Wellington's campaign," he said. "Which year did he enter the Indian subcontinent?" It was a test. Clara recognized it immediately, the particular tone of a man who expects to catch someone out. "Wellington himself did not enter India," Clara said calmly. "You are perhaps thinking of his brother Richard, who served as Governor General. Arthur Wellesley fought in the Fourth Anglo-Mysore War in 1799. If you are testing my knowledge of the period, Your Grace, I would suggest we have that conversation somewhere the children are not using it as entertainment." Annabelle covered her mouth. Thomas looked at the ceiling. The Duke's jaw tightened. "You are dismissed for the day, Miss Ashford." Clara looked at him steadily. "It is 10 o'clock in the morning." "Then you have a great deal of afternoon ahead of you." He moved to the door and held it open, not as a courtesy, but as a conclusion. "Mrs. Baird will settle your wages for the week. I trust you can find your way to the village from here." The first drop of rain hit the window 30 seconds after Clara walked out of the schoolroom. By the time she had retrieved her bag from the east wing, she had not unpacked much, a habit of the careful. The sky had turned the specific shade of greenish-gray that meant the kind of rain that does not apologize. She stood at the servant's entrance and looked at the road. 3 miles to the village. No carriage had been offered. She had not asked for one because she already knew the answer. Mrs. Baird appeared behind her, looking genuinely uncomfortable for the first time since Clara had arrived. "Miss Ashford, I could ask." "No need," Clara said. The road floods past the old mill. if you go through Fenwick's field and then cut along. Thank you, Mrs. Baird. She walked out into the rain. The Duke left for the village at 10:30. He told himself it was business. There was a matter at the solicitor's office that had been waiting, and the rain, though inconvenient, was not enough to delay it. He told himself he was not thinking about the governess on the road. He had dismissed staff before. It was not a complicated act. He did not look toward the road as he rode out. He looked once. The road was empty. Good, he thought, and rode faster. The village of Wrentham was 12 minutes by horse on a dry day. In the rain, on a road that had begun to pool in the low places, it was closer to 20. The Duke arrived at the solicitor's office, handed his horse to the boy at the post, and pushed open the door of the Crown and Anchor across the street first, because the solicitor kept poor hours and poorer tea. The inn was warm and smelled of wood smoke and bread. And there at the small table nearest the fire sat Clara Ashford. Dry. Her hair was neat. Her back was straight. She had a cup of tea in front of her and a book open beside it, and she was reading with the complete composure of someone who had been sitting there for quite some time. The Duke stopped in the doorway. Clara looked up. Her expression did not change, but something moved behind her eyes, the very faintest suggestion of satisfaction, there and gone in less than a second. "Your Grace," she said pleasantly, "did you have a difficult ride?" He stood in the doorway of the Crown and Anchor, rain dripping from his coat onto the flagstone floor, and stared at a woman who had left his estate on foot, in a downpour, 3 miles from the village, 20 minutes before him. And arrived first. "How?" he said and stopped. Clara turned a page of her book. "The tea here is quite good," she said. "I recommend it." The Duke of Wrentham had faced down creditors, Parliament, and a Napoleonic skirmish outside Brussels without losing his composure. He had met his match in a governess with a worn leather bag and no carriage. The question was, did he know it yet? The Duke ordered nothing. He stood at the entrance of the Crown and Anchor for exactly 4 seconds, long enough to establish in his own mind that he was not flustered, that the situation was entirely ordinary, and that a governess sitting dry and composed in a village inn after a 3-mile walk through a rainstorm was not, in any meaningful sense, his concern. Then he sat down at the table across from her. He was not entirely sure why. "The solicitor keeps poor hours," he said, by way of explanation to no one in particular. Said Clara, turning another page. The innkeeper's wife appeared. The Duke ordered tea without looking up from the middle distance, where he was busy not thinking about the question that was eating a very neat hole through his composure. 3 miles, rain, no carriage, 20 minutes. "Miss Ashford." "Your Grace." "How did you get here?" It was not quite a question. It came out flat, the way his sentences did when he was working very hard to sound as though something did not matter to him. Clara looked up from her book. She considered him for a moment, not nervously, not with deference, but with the calm attention of someone deciding how much to give away. "I found a way," she said. "I always do." "That is not an answer." "No," she agreed pleasantly, "it isn't." His tea arrived. He wrapped both hands around the cup and looked at her with the expression of a man who was accustomed to receiving complete information and found its absence genuinely offensive. "There is no shortcut to the village from the manor. I know this road." "There is no shortcut on the road," Clara said. "I didn't use the road." He waited. She closed her book, folded her hands on top of it, and looked at him with something that was almost not quite, but almost amusement. "Mrs. Baird mentioned Fenwick's field. I crossed it, followed the drainage ditch to the old mill, and from there it is less than 1/2 mile along the river path. dry ground mostly under the tree line. She paused. Your coachman would know the route, I think, if you ever asked him. The Duke said nothing. I grew up in the country, Your Grace. I know how to read land. There was a silence. Outside, the rain pressed itself against the windows with renewed enthusiasm. You grew up in the country, he repeated, in the tone of a man cataloging information he had not expected to need. I did. Where? The briefest pause, so brief that a less observant man would have missed it entirely. Shropshire, she said, it rains there too. He rode back to the manor an hour later. He told himself the decision was already forming before he walked back through the front door. He told himself it was entirely about the children, who had, according to Mrs. Baird's uncomfortable report, refused their lunch and sat in the schoolroom in stubborn, unified silence for the better part of the morning. Thomas had apparently said, to anyone who would listen, that Annabelle would cry herself sick by nightfall. Annabelle had apparently said, to anyone who would listen, that she was not going to cry. She was simply not going to speak ever again to anyone in this house. The Duke stood in the corridor outside the schoolroom and listened to the silence coming from behind the door and felt something in his chest that he would not have dignified with a name. He sent for Mrs. Baird. Send word to the village, he said. Ask Miss Ashford to return. Mrs. Baird's expression flickered with something that might have been relief, or might have been the specific satisfaction of a woman who has watched powerful men reverse themselves before, and finds it quietly gratifying every time. Of course, Your Grace. And have her room fire lit before she arrives. It was cold when she came. Mrs. Baird said nothing about the fact that she had mentioned this 3 days ago. She simply nodded and went. Clara arrived at 4 o'clock. She had not hurried. The Duke noted this from the upstairs window and chose not to examine why he had been standing at the upstairs window. She came through the front door this time, not the servant's entrance. He was not sure if that was Mrs. Baird's doing or her own. He suspected her own. He met her in the entrance hall. She stood with her bag at her feet and looked at him with an expression that gave him absolutely nothing to work with. Miss Ashford, he said, I would like you to return to your position. I see, said Clara. He waited for something more. Agreement, perhaps. Gratitude. The ordinary response of someone who has just been offered reinstatement after dismissal. Clara tilted her head very slightly. The curriculum, she said. He blinked. I beg your pardon. The curriculum. I would like some latitude with it. Not unlimited, I understand there are expectations. But Thomas is ready for political history and Annabelle is ready for natural science. If I am to do this properly, I need to be able to teach them properly. The Duke looked at her for a long moment. No one spoke to him like this. Not staff, not peers, not in recent memory, anyone at all. His last Nishinlissi had spent 2 years agreeing with everything he said before running off to Italy with a painter, which in retrospect perhaps said something about the quality of relentless agreement as a foundation for human connection. Fine, he said. Clara nodded once. And Miss Ashford, he said, as she picked up her bag. She looked back. Next time I dismiss you, he stopped. Something about the sentence, once spoken aloud, revealed its own absurdity. Next time. As though he already knew there would be a next time. As though the household had simply adjusted its geometry to include her and would require significant effort to exclude her again. Yes, Your Grace, Clara said with perfect patience. He said nothing. I'll find a way, she said quietly and went upstairs. That evening, the Duke sat at his desk in the study and stared at the letter tray in the corner. The document was still there, half tucked beneath the silver edge. He had looked at it every day for 3 weeks. He had written two letters in response to it and sent neither. He had told himself he was waiting for the right moment, the right approach, the right something. He pulled it out now and read it again, though he already knew every word. The Ashford Estate, Shropshire. He looked at the name at the top of the page. Baron Edmund Ashford. He looked at the door through which his new governess had just walked. Shropshire, she had said, it rains there too. The Duke set the document down very carefully on the desk in front of him, as though it might, if handled incorrectly, detonate. He had known something was wrong since the second morning. He had told himself it was a coincidence. Names were common. Shropshire was a large county. There was no reason, no sensible, rational reason, to connect a governess with a worn leather bag to a document that had been keeping him from sleeping for the better part of a month. But the Duke of Wrentham had not built what he had built by ignoring the things that didn't add up. And Clara Ashford did not add up at all. Clara waited 3 days. Not because she was uncertain. She had been certain since the moment she saw the seal in the corridor, that particular cold, clarifying certainty that settles into the chest like a stone dropped into still water. She knew what the document was. She knew what it meant. She had been carrying the shape of it in her memory for 4 years. Since the morning her father sat across from her at the breakfast table in Shropshire and told her, with the quiet devastation of a man who has already exhausted his options, that the estate was gone. Not lost, not sold. Gone, signed away under circumstances that her father, to his dying day, had never been able to fully explain, because the man across the table had been a duke, and barons did not, in 1809, ask dukes for explanations. She had been 19 years old. She waited 3 days because 3 days was how long it took to establish that the Duke left his study unlocked between the hours of 2 and 4 in the afternoon, when he rode out regardless of weather, and that Mrs. Baird took her rest at 2:30, and that Thomas and Annabelle could be reliably occupied with an independent drawing exercise for 40 minutes without requiring supervision. On the third afternoon, Clara walked into the Duke's study and closed the door behind her. The room smelled of wood smoke and old leather, and something faintly chemical, ink, perhaps, or the particular smell of documents that have been handled many times by anxious hands. She did not rush. She moved to the desk with the same composure she brought to everything, scanned the surface without touching anything, and found what she was looking for almost immediately. He had not hidden it. That struck her as significant. Either he was careless, which nothing about him suggested, or he had, in some part of himself, left it where it could be found. She picked it up. It was longer than she had expected. 6 pages, not 2, with annotations in the margins in a hand she did not recognize and one she did. Her father's cramped, careful script, growing less careful toward the final page, the letters beginning to list slightly, the way his writing always did when he was frightened. She read it from the beginning. By page 3, her hands had stopped being entirely steady. By page 5, she understood something she had not understood before. The estate had not been taken. It had been used as collateral, her father's signature on a loan agreement, witnessed and legal, dated 3 months before his death. The loan had come from the Wrentham estate accounts. The collateral had been called in 6 weeks after her father died, when she had been too young and too grief-stunned, and too thoroughly without legal standing to contest anything. She had always assumed malice. Clean, simple, intentional malice, the kind that was easy to hold on to because it required no further questions. But in the margin of page 4 in the Duke's hand, not the previous Duke, she realized with a start, looking at the date. This Duke, James Calloway, who had inherited 3 years after the transaction and apparently gone looking for the original paperwork, was a single line. This should not have been called in, find the air. Four words and instruction. Find the air. Clara stood in the middle of the study with six pages in her hands and the particular discomfort of a woman whose anger has been her compass for 4 years and has just discovered that the map was wrong. She read the line again. Then she put the document back exactly as she had found it, smoothed the edge of the letter tray, and walked out of the study. She was halfway up the stairs when she heard the front door. He was early. She did not run. Running would have been both undignified and unnecessary. She was on the stairs, not in the study, and there was no reason for a governess to avoid the main staircase. She kept her pace even, her expression neutral, and was nearly at the landing when his voice came from below. "Miss Ashford." She stopped, turned. He was standing in the entrance hall, still in his riding coat, looking up at her with an expression she had not seen on him before. Not impatience. Not the cool dismissal of their early interactions. Something more careful than that. Something that looked, uncomfortably, like a man who has been thinking about something for a long time and has just decided to stop thinking and act. "Would you join me in the study?" he said. It was not quite a question. Clara looked at him for one full second. "Of course," she said. He did not go to his desk. He stood by the window instead, which she noticed, because it was the position of a man who wanted the option of looking away. He had removed his riding gloves and was holding them in one hand, turning them slowly, the way people handle objects when their hands need something to do. Clara stood near the door and waited. "How long have you known?" he said. "Not asterisk what do you know. Not I'd like to ask you something. Straight to it then." She had expected that he was not, whatever else he was, a man who circled. "Since the first day," she said. "The corridor, I saw the seal." He nodded slowly, as though confirming something he had already calculated. "And you stayed?"
"I stayed."
"Why?" Clara considered the question. There were several true answers. She chose the most honest one. "Because I wanted to understand what you intended to do with it." He turned from the window then. He looked at her directly, really looked, the way he hadn't permitted himself to before or hadn't allowed her to notice. "I intend to return it," he said. "The estate. Or its value, the estate itself has been tenanted for 4 years, which complicates the matter legally, but the land value and the income accrued can be..." He stopped. Something in her expression had made him stop.
"What?"
"You've already spoken to a solicitor," Clara said slowly.
3 months ago."
"That was before I arrived."
"Yes."
She looked at him. He looked at her. The fire in the grate made the only sound in the room for a long moment. "You didn't know where I was," she said.
"No, your father had no surviving relatives on record. You had," he paused.
"You had disappeared rather thoroughly, Miss Ashford." Clara thought of 4 years of careful, deliberate erasure. New name, Ashford had been her mother's family. New county. New references, built slowly and honestly from nothing. New life, constructed from the wreckage of the old one with the same methodical competence she brought to everything. She had not disappeared, she had rebuilt. "How did I end up here?" she said. It was not quite a question either. The Duke was quiet for a moment. "My mother," he said, "has a very old friendship with the agency that placed you." Clara thought of Lady Portia. The way she had looked at her on the first morning, not with the mild curiosity of a woman inspecting new staff, but with something older and more specific. Recognition, perhaps, or the satisfied expression of someone watching the first move of a game they arranged themselves.
"Your mother knows who I am," Clara said.
"My mother," the Duke said, with the particular weariness of a man who loves someone and finds them profoundly exhausting, "has known who you are since before you arrived. She also knew about the document. She decided that the most efficient solution was to..."
He gestured vaguely. "Put us in the same house," Clara finished. "Yes." Clara looked at the fire. She had come here for answers. She had found them, and they were nothing like what she had prepared for. There was no villain in this room. There was a man standing by a window holding his riding gloves and looking at her with an expression that had something genuine in it, something that had not been there a week ago and could not, now that she had seen it, be entirely unseen. That was, in its own way, the most inconvenient thing that had happened to her in 4 years. "I need to think," she said. "Of course." She moved to the door, stopped with her hand on the frame. "The line in the margin," she said without turning around. "Page 4, Find the Air. When did you write that?" A pause. "The week I inherited," he said quietly, "3 years ago." Clara nodded once, though he couldn't see it. She walked out and closed the door softly behind her. She had arrived at Wrentham Manor with a stone in her chest, and a 4-year-old wound she had kept clean and sharp because sharp things, at least, were useful. She walked up the stairs to the east wing and sat on the edge of her bed in the cold afternoon light and realized, with the uncomfortable clarity of someone who has just lost their oldest enemy, that she was not sure what came next. The Duke of Wrentham had been looking for her for 3 years. The question she could not answer, the one that sat at the bottom of everything now, quiet and insistent as water finding its level, was why that changed anything at all. And why, God help her, it did. The invitation arrived on a Tuesday. Clara knew about it before the Duke did, because invitations to Wrentham Manor passed through Mrs. Baird first, and Mrs. Baird had a habit of leaving correspondence on the entrance hall table for precisely 4 minutes before delivering it, 4 minutes during which the entire household somehow became aware of its contents. It was not gossip, exactly. It was more like weather. Information that moved through the house on its own currents, arriving everywhere at once. The Harwick Autumn Ball. Saturday. All of county society, which in this particular corner of England meant approximately 40 families who had been watching each other with polite intensity for generations, and had long since exhausted the pretense that they were doing anything other than that. Clara heard about it from Annabelle, who had heard about it from the upstairs maid, who had heard about it from the coachman, who had apparently been asked to prepare the good carriage. "Are you going?" Annabelle asked, with the particular urgency of a 6-year-old for whom balls existed primarily as occasions for elaborate dresses. "Governesses don't generally attend balls," Clara said, and returned her attention to the natural science text she had been reading aloud. "But you're not a general governess," Annabelle said with complete confidence. "Thomas said so." Clara looked at Thomas, who was examining the ceiling with sudden great interest. "What," Clara said, "did Thomas say exactly?" "Thomas said nothing." "He said you speak like a lady," Annabelle supplied helpfully, "and that you know things dukes don't know, which means you can't be ordinary." Clara looked at the page in front of her for a moment. "That is very kind of Thomas," she said. "Now, the migration patterns of the Arctic tern." The Duke appeared in the schoolroom doorway on Wednesday afternoon. This had become, over the past week, less unusual than it had been in the first days. He did not announce himself or explain his presence. He simply appeared, occasionally, and listened, and sometimes, rarely, and always as though he hadn't meant to, asked a question or made a correction that opened into a 20-minute discussion that the children absorbed with the focused intensity of small creatures recognizing, instinctively, that something real was happening. Clara had stopped being unsettled by it. She was working on not being aware of it. These were different things. He waited until the children had been released for their afternoon walk before he spoke. "The Harwick Ball is Saturday," he said. "I'm aware," Clara said, stacking atlases with the efficient movements of someone who has a great deal to do and intends to do it. The children have asked to attend. They are too young for the ball itself, but the Harwicks have arranged an early supper for families with young children. Mrs. Harwick specifically, he paused. She requested that you accompany them. Clara set down the atlas she was holding. Mrs. Harwick requested me specifically. She did. She has never met me. No, the Duke said. He was looking somewhere slightly to the left of her, which she had learned was what he did when he was saying something he found uncomfortable. My mother may have mentioned you. Clara looked at him. Lady Portia. Again. Moving pieces on a board that no one had agreed to play on, with the serene confidence of a woman who had decided that the ends were so obviously correct that the means required no particular justification. I see, Clara said. You don't have to come, he said, and something in the way he said it slightly too quickly, slightly too carefully neutral, told her that he very much wanted her to. She picked up the atlas again. I'll need to press my good dress, she said. The blue one has a loose hem. I'll need thread. Mrs. Baird will arrange it. Then I suppose I'm attending a ball. Saturday arrived with the specific cruelty of autumn mornings that are beautiful and cold in equal measure. The sky, a hard, clear blue. The grounds of Wrentham gilded with fallen leaves that looked magnificent and made every path treacherous. Clara dressed without ceremony. The blue dress was her best and only formal option, a deep midnight blue, simply cut, without the excessive ornamentation that current fashion demanded, and that she had never had the budget for even when she had a budget. It was 4 years old. It was also, she knew objectively, extremely well made, because it had been made by her mother's modiste in the last season before everything had ended, and good construction did not age the way fashion did. She pinned her hair herself. No maid, she had never asked for one and didn't intend to start. She looked at herself in the small mirror above the washstand for exactly 3 seconds. Then she went to collect the children. Annabel took one look at her in the corridor and said, with absolute conviction, "You look like a queen." "I look like a governess in a blue dress," Clara said, straightening Annabel's ribbon. "Same thing," said Annabel. Thomas, who expressed approval exclusively through the absence of criticism, said nothing, and offered Clara his arm with the grave formality of a 9-year-old, who had been paying close attention to how adults conducted themselves, and had decided to begin practicing immediately. Clara accepted it with equal gravity. "Very correct, Thomas," she said. He stood approximately an inch taller for the rest of the evening. The Harwick estate was 20 minutes by carriage, and the Duke rode alongside rather than within, which Clara thought was probably deliberate and chose not to examine further. The children pressed their faces to the carriage window and catalogued everything they passed with the running commentary of young people for whom the world is still primarily interesting. Clara watched the darkening fields and thought about nothing in particular, which was to say she thought about everything she was trying not to think about, in the disciplined, circular way of someone who is very good at controlling their thoughts and is currently failing. Find the heir, 3 years ago, the week he inherited. She had turned this over every night since the study, had taken it apart and reassembled it, looking for the angle that made it less than it appeared to be, the self-interest, the legal obligation, the pragmatic motivation that would reduce it to something manageable. She had not found one. This was, she was discovering, significantly more inconvenient than having found one would have been. The Harwick estate glowed from half a mile away, every window lit, carriages moving in a slow, glittering procession up the drive. The sound of music reached them before they arrived, strings, lively and warm, spilling out into the cold air like something that had escaped from somewhere more generous than an English autumn. The children's supper was in the East Drawing Room, chaperoned by a cheerful army of Harwick cousins, and served at a table that Annabel immediately declared superior to anything at Wrentham, a verdict she delivered at a volume that made Clara press her lips together to contain something that was not quite a smile. She settled the children, confirmed they were fed, entertained, and unlikely to cause international incident. Then she slipped into the corridor. She had intended to find a quiet corner, a window seat, perhaps, or a chair in one of the smaller rooms that would not be in use. She was here as a chaperone, not a guest. There were lines, and she understood them, and she had long since made her peace with standing on the functional side of them. She did not, as it turned out, find a quiet corner. She found the ballroom. Not deliberately. The house was large, and the corridors redirected her twice, and then a door opened, and the music was suddenly much louder, and she was standing at the edge of a room that contained, in its entirety, the social machinery of the county, women in silk and velvet, men in tailored black, candles multiplied 100 times in long mirrors, flowers banked against every wall, and the particular energy of a room full of people who are performing enjoyment, and have been doing it long enough that the performance has become indistinguishable from the real thing. Clara stood in the doorway. She had grown up in rooms like this. She had learned to dance in a room like this, in Shropshire, in a house that no longer belonged to her family, at parties hosted by her father when her father was still alive, and the world was still the shape she had been raised to expect. She had told herself in the 4 years since that she did not miss it. Standing in the doorway of the Harwick Ballroom, she discovered that this had been, at best, an oversimplification. Miss Ashford. She turned. Lady Portia was beside her. The Duchess Dowager of Wrentham was a small woman who managed, through some combination of posture and personality, to occupy significantly more space than her physical dimensions warranted. She was dressed in deep green, her white hair immaculately arranged, her eyes dark, sharp, and entirely too perceptive, fixed on Clara with an expression that contained several layers of meaning and offered none of them freely. "Your Grace," Clara said, with the composure she had spent 4 years building specifically for moments like this. "You look very well," Lady Portia said, in the tone of a woman confirming something she had predicted. "I hoped you would wear something with color. So many young women default to gray when they are uncertain of their position. You did not." "I wasn't uncertain of my position," Clara said. "I'm a governess at a family supper," said Lady Portia, which communicated, efficiently, that she found this description both technically accurate and fundamentally incorrect. She took Clara's arm, simply, as though this were already established, as though they had walked into rooms together before, and moved her forward into the ballroom. "There are people here who knew your father," she said quietly. "They will recognize you. Some of them will pretend they don't. Pay attention to which ones." Clara looked at her. "You arranged this." "I arranged the invitation," Lady Portia said serenely. "What happens next is entirely up to you and my son, which is as it should be. I have learned in 71 years that one can position the pieces, but one cannot move them. That is the children's job." She patted Clara's hand. "Now smile, not because anyone deserves it, but because it is the most unsettling thing you can do when people are expecting you to be diminished." Clara looked at the room. She smiled. It happened at 9:20. Clara had been standing near the far windows with a glass of lemonade. She had no intention of drinking, watching the room with the trained observation of someone who had grown up knowing that what people did at parties was more informative than anything they said, when she felt the quality of attention in the room shift. Not dramatically, not all at once, but in the particular way that social attention moves, a glance, then another, then a murmur, then a cluster of murmurs, until she became aware, with the slow certainty of a tide coming in, that she was being looked at. She did not change her posture. She did not touch her hair or check her dress or perform any of the small nervous adjustments that would have told the room it had landed. She simply continued to observe. Across the room, she saw a woman she recognized, Mrs. Dalton, whose husband had been a business acquaintance of her father's, who had come to the house in Shropshire twice for dinner and had been perfectly pleasant. Mrs. Dalton was looking at her now with an expression that moved through several stages, uncertainty, recognition, something that looked almost like guilt, before resolving into a smile that did not reach her eyes and a deliberate turn in the other direction. Clara noted this, filed it. She was watching a man near the fireplace, Sir Edmund Graves, who had known her father well enough to attend the funeral, do something similar when she heard the Duke's voice behind her. "There you are." She turned. He had come to stand beside her without her noticing, which was unusual enough that she registered it. He was looking at the room, not at her, with the expression of a man who has been watching the same thing she has been watching and does not find it comfortable. "They recognize me," she said quietly. "Some of them word travels." He paused. "Are you all right?" The question surprised her, not because it was asked he had been since the study, perceptibly different in ways she was still cataloging, but because of how it was asked. No performance in it, no social obligation, just the question, plain and direct. "I'm perfectly fine," she said, which was mostly true. "You don't have to be here. I can have the carriage." "I'm not leaving," she said, with a quiet certainty that closed the subject. He was quiet for a moment. "Your father was well-liked," he said then carefully. "The people who are looking away, it isn't because they disliked him. It's because they did like him and they didn't help, and that is the kind of thing people find it easier to avoid than to address." Clara looked at Sir Edmund Graves, who was now discussing something with great animation with someone else entirely, his back firmly toward her. "I know," she said. "I worked that out a long time ago." "Does it make it easier?" "No," she said, "but it makes it cleaner. There's only one person in this room responsible for what happened to my family's estate." She felt him go still beside her. "And that person," she continued, "wrote Find the Heir in the margin of a document 3 years ago and has apparently been attempting, in the most indirect possible way, to correct something he didn't cause." A pause. "You could simply have written me a letter," she said. "I didn't know where you were," he said. "I told you that." "You could have tried harder." "Yes," he said simply, "I could have." She looked at him. He was still looking at the room, jaw set, and she understood suddenly that this was not indifference. It was the particular discipline of a man who is feeling something he doesn't entirely trust himself to show in a room full of people who are already paying attention. It was, in its way, familiar. She had been doing the same thing for 4 years. The music shifted, the orchestra moving from a reel into something slower, more deliberate. "Dance with me," he said. Clara turned to look at him fully. "I'm a governess," she said, "at a family supper." "You're a baron's daughter at a county ball," he said, and finally looked at her. "And I am asking you to dance." The room, she was aware, was watching. Lady Portia, she was aware, was watching from somewhere to her left with the expression of a woman trying very hard to look as though she is not watching. Clara thought about lines, and which side of them she stood on, and what it meant that the side she had been standing on for 4 years was beginning to feel less like a position, and more like a habit she had never examined. "One dance," she said. He danced well. She had not expected to notice this, and then immediately recognized the foolishness of not expecting to notice it, because she was dancing with him in a room full of people and noticing things was simply what she did. He was precise without being rigid. He led without being controlling. He maintained exactly the correct formal distance and looked at her with an expression that communicated, with remarkable clarity, that the formal distance was something he was observing out of respect rather than preference. "You've been taught well," he said after the first turn. "My mother insisted," Clara said. She believed that a woman should be able to do anything in a ballroom that a man could do, and do it better, and make it look effortless. "She sounds formidable." "She was," a pause. "She died when I was 17, 2 years before my father." "I'm sorry," he said. And then, because he was apparently constitutionally incapable of leaving things at the comfortable surface, "Was that when the financial difficulties began?" "The difficulties were already there," Clara said. "My mother's death just removed the person who had been quietly managing them." He was quiet for one full rotation. "My father was the same," he said then. "Not financially, but there were things my mother managed that no one understood the weight of until she stopped managing them." He paused. "She didn't die. She simply decided she had done enough and handed it all to me." "How old were you?"
24.
"That's very young to inherit a dukedom." "It's very young to inherit anything," he said. "The things that come with it included." Clara understood, without him saying so, that the things that came with it included the document. The estate. The loan his father had called in. The collateral that had swallowed a baron's legacy whole. The paperwork that had landed on a 24-year-old duke's desk like a debt he hadn't incurred and couldn't ignore. The music began a slow toward its conclusion. "I am going to speak to my solicitor on Monday," he said quietly, low enough that it was only for her. "I should have done it sooner. I should have found you sooner. I am aware of that."
"Yes," she said, "you should have."
"I'm telling you now so that you know it is not contingent on," he stopped, started again. "It is not contingent on anything. The estate, or its value, is yours regardless of anything else. I want that to be clear." Clara looked at him. The music was drawing to its final bars.
"It's clear," she said.
"Good."
"It's also," she said, "the least romantic thing anyone has ever said to me during a waltz."
He blinked.
For one extraordinary moment, brief as a struck match, something moved across his face that was entirely unguarded. Startled, warm, almost a smile. The music stopped. Clara stepped back and curtsied with perfect correctness.
"Thank you for the dance, Your Grace," she said, and walked away before he could recover himself, because she was, above all things, a woman who understood the value of an exit.
She found Lady Portia at the edge of the room, holding a glass of champagne with the serenity of a woman who has recently watched something go exactly as she planned. Lady Portia leaned close.
"He knows who you are, my dear," she said quietly. "He has known since the second day."
Clara looked across the room to where the Duke was standing, still in the same spot, watching her with an expression he had apparently stopped bothering to manage.
"I know," Clara said.
"And yet," said Lady Portia, "here you both are." Clara looked at her champagne.
"Here we both are," she said.
The carriage home was quiet. The children slept against each other in the corner, Annabelle's head on Thomas's shoulder, Thomas's hand loosely holding his sister's in the unconscious solidarity of siblings who bicker constantly and love each other completely. Clara watched the dark fields past the window. The Duke rode alongside. Once, near the crossroads where she had first arrived, she glanced out and found him already looking toward the carriage, toward the window, toward her, with an expression she could see even in the dark, even at that distance, because it was the kind of expression that does not require proximity to be legible. She looked away first, but only just. She had come to Wrentham Manor to understand what the Duke intended. She understood it now. The question,
the one she took upstairs with her, and set beside her on the cold bed in the east wing room with the window overlooking the stables, was what she intended. And she had no answer. Not yet. But for the first time in 4 years, the absence of an answer did not feel like a wound. It felt like a door. The solicitor's letter arrived on Monday, as promised. Clara knew about it the same way she knew about everything at Wrentham Manor, through the 4-minute window on the entrance hall table, through Mrs. Baird's carefully neutral expression, through the particular quality of silence that settles over a house when something significant has entered it and is waiting to be addressed. She did not read it. She did not go near it. She took the children to the schoolroom and spent the morning on mathematics, which required the kind of focused attention that left no room for anything else, and told herself that whatever was in that letter was the Duke's business to manage, his solicitor's language to navigate, his conscience to satisfy. She had been telling herself variations of this for 3 days. She was becoming less convincing. Thomas noticed first, because Thomas noticed everything and had the particular gift of 9-year-olds who have grown up in quiet houses, the ability to read the emotional weather of adults with an accuracy that the adults themselves would find alarming if they knew about it. He waited until Annabelle had gone to find her sketchbook before he set down his pencil and looked at Clara directly. "Are you leaving?" he said. Clara looked up from the marking she had been doing. "No." "You seem like you're deciding something." "I am always deciding something," Clara said. "That is the nature of being an adult, Thomas. It is a constant series of decisions, most of them less interesting than they appear." Thomas considered this. "Father seems like he's deciding something, too." Clara set down her pen very carefully. "Does he?" "He rode out yesterday and came back after an hour, which he never does. Usually he's gone all day." Thomas picked up his pencil again, examining the point with excessive attention, and he asked Mrs. Baird if your room fire had been lit. He asked specifically. Clara said nothing. "He asked yesterday," Thomas added, "and the day before." "Thomas," Clara said. "Yes." "Mathematics." Thomas returned to his work with the expression of someone who has said what he intended to say and is content to let it sit. She was in the library after supper when the Duke found her. Not the study, the library, which was a different room entirely, larger and colder and lined floor to ceiling with the accumulated reading of several generations of Calloways, most of it unread and some of it excellent. Clara had discovered, in her first week, that the library contained a remarkable collection of natural history texts that predated anything she had seen in the schoolroom, and she had been systematically working her way through them in the evenings, with the focused pleasure of someone rediscovering a country they had been exiled from. She heard the door and did not look up. He came to stand at the end of the shelving nearest her chair. She could see him in her peripheral vision, still in his dinner clothes, which meant he had not yet gone upstairs, which meant he had come here deliberately rather than in passing. She turned a page. "The solicitor sent the preliminary documents," he said. "I know, I saw the letter arrive. I'd like to go over them with you. Not tonight, there's a great deal of legal language that requires," he stopped, started differently. "I want you to have someone review them on your behalf, someone who represents your interests specifically. I'll cover the cost." Clara looked up from her book for the first time. "You'll cover the cost," she repeated. "It's the least." "If you say it's the least I can do, I will put this book down and leave the room," she said, with perfect calm. He closed his mouth. "I am not a charity," she said. "I am not a debt being settled. I am a person who is owed something that was taken, and I am capable of arranging my own legal representation, which I will do, and you will send the documents to whomever I designate, and we will proceed correctly and without. She stopped.
Without what? He said quietly.
She looked at the fire.
Without making it into something it shouldn't be, she said.
The room was very quiet. Outside, the wind had picked up. She could hear it moving through the eaves, the particular low sound of an old house settling into a cold night.
And what shouldn't it be? He said.
Clara set the book down in her lap.
This was the moment, she recognized, that she had been navigating toward and away from simultaneously for 2 weeks. The moment that Lady Portia had arranged the furniture for. The moment that the document and the letter and the ball and the dance had all been building toward with the quiet inevitability of water finding the lowest point of a landscape. She had known it was coming. She had been in her careful, methodical way preparing arguments against it. The arguments had been good, logical, entirely sound. They had also been, she was discovering, completely useless against the specific reality of him standing at the end of the bookshelf looking at her, with an expression that had nothing managed about it whatsoever.
I came here, she said carefully, with a very clear understanding of what I was doing and why.
I know. I was going to find out what you intended and act accordingly and then leave. That was the plan.
I know, he said again.
Plans of that kind depend on the other party behaving predictably.
Something shifted in his expression, and I haven't.
You wrote "Find the Heir" in the margin of a document 3 years ago, Clara said. You hired your mother's modiste agency specifically because she told you to. You asked Mrs. Baird about my fire every day for a week.
You are not, she said, with the faintest edge of something that was not quite exasperation, a predictable man.
He moved then, not toward her, not dramatically, just shifting his weight in the way of someone who has been holding very still and has decided to stop.
I owe you an apology, he said, not for the estate that is being addressed separately and correctly, but for the first week, the boots, the dismissal, the rain.
Clara looked at him steadily.
The rain, she said, turned out to be instructive.
It turned out to be the most efficient way I've ever been humiliated, he said, and there was something in his voice, dry, self-aware, just barely warm, that she had not heard from him before, and that did something entirely inconvenient to her composure.
You weren't humiliated, she said. You were surprised.
For me, he said, they are the same thing.
She almost smiled. She caught it just in time, which she suspected he noticed anyway, because he noticed everything she tried not to show him, had been noticing it since the corridor on the first day with an attention that was both flattering and deeply inconvenient.
James, she said, and then stopped, because she had not intended to use his name, had not meant to let it out of the careful container she had been keeping it in, and the sound of it in the quiet library hung between them with a weight that neither of them seemed to know what to do with.
He went very still.
Clara, he said, and the way he said it, quietly, as though he had been waiting for permission, made the room feel significantly smaller than it had a moment ago.
She stood up.
Not away from him. Just up, because sitting while he stood had suddenly become untenable, had become a posture of diminishment she was not willing to maintain in this conversation, in this moment, with this man looking at her like that.
She was taller than she appeared sitting. She had always carried herself as though she were taller still.
I have been managing my feelings about this situation, she said, with the precision of someone choosing every word, with a great deal of discipline and a moderate amount of success.
I know, he said, so have I.
I am not, she said, in a position to, the estate is not settled. My circumstances are not, I am currently employed in your household as.
Clara, I am speaking.
I know I'm listening.
She looked at him. He was close enough now that she could see the particular quality of his attention, the way he listened with his whole face, as though what she was saying was the only thing happening in the world, which she recognized as both entirely genuine and profoundly unfair.
"I don't trust easily," she said.
"I know that too."
"4 years," she said, "I built everything I have, everything I am now, from nothing, on my own. I do not require," she stopped, took a breath. "I am not looking to be saved."
"I'm not trying to save you," he said, with a quiet certainty that she believed immediately, which was itself surprising, because she had not expected to believe him so immediately.
"You don't need saving. You arrived before I did in a rainstorm with no carriage. You walked into my study and read a document that concerned your entire future and walked out without showing a single thing on your face. You taught my children things I couldn't and corrected me in front of them without apology."
He paused.
"I'm not trying to save you. I am trying," he said carefully, "to ask whether there is any version of the future you are planning in which I am also present."
The fire settled in the grate. The wind moved through the eaves. Clara looked at him for a long moment.
"That," she said, "is an extraordinarily careful way to say something."
"I'm an extraordinarily careful man."
"You sent me out in the rain, without a carriage, on day 4.
"I was," he said, "in the process of becoming more careful."
This time she did smile. She didn't catch it. She wasn't entirely sure she tried.
He saw it, and something in his face opened. Not dramatically, not with the performed emotion of a man making a gesture, but with the quiet, private relief of someone who has been waiting for something and has just seen it arrive.
He took one step forward.
She did not step back.
"I need time," she said.
"You have it.
The estate needs to be settled first, properly, independently."
"Agreed completely."
"And I will not," she said, "give up the teaching, even after. I'm good at it and I find it meaningful, and I won't give it up for a title or a household or anything else."
He looked at her with an expression that she was learning to read, the one that meant he was recalibrating, filing something away, adjusting his understanding.
"The children would be devastated to lose you," he said.
"That is not what I asked."
"No," he said, "it isn't." He met her eyes directly.
"You won't have to give up anything, Clara. That is not the version of the future I'm proposing."
She looked at him.
"I don't know," she said honestly, "what the version of the future you're proposing looks like."
"Neither do I," he said with equal honesty.
"Not exactly, but I know the general shape of it."
"And what shape is that?"
He was quiet for a moment.
"One where you don't have to walk anywhere in the rain alone," he said,
"and where you still arrive first, because that is apparently simply what you do, and I have decided I would rather stand at the door waiting for you than be anywhere else."
Clara looked at the fire.
She thought about 4 years, about the morning her father told her with his careful, devastated voice that the estate was gone. About the day she packed her single bag and walked out of the house she had grown up in for the last time. About the long, methodical work of building a life from the pieces of a broken one. The references earned one at a time. The name quietly changed. The grief compressed into something small enough to carry without being seen carrying it. She thought about a man who had inherited a document. He didn't create and written 4 words in the margin, and spent 3 years trying to find her.
She thought about Thomas offering her his arm in the corridor with 9-year-old gravity.
She thought about Annabelle saying, "You look like a queen."
She thought about a waltz and the distance that had been maintained out of respect rather than preference, and the fact that she had noticed the difference.
"I need to think," she said.
"I know.
I may need several days."
"Take them."
She moved toward the door, stopped.
"James," she said, and this time she meant to say it.
He looked at her.
"The general shape," she said. "I don't object to the general shape."
She left before she could see his expression change, but she heard,
just barely, just at the edge of perception. The long, quiet exhale of a man who has been holding his breath for longer than he realized. She did not sleep that night. Not from distress, or not primarily from distress. More from the particular wakefulness of a mind that has been handed something new and cannot stop turning it over, examining it from every angle, testing its weight. She lay in the narrow bed in the east wing room with the window overlooking the stables, listening to the wind, and thought about the general shape of things. It was not, she decided somewhere around 2 in the morning, that she was afraid of being wrong about him. She was, if she was honest, and she was always honest, especially with herself, especially in the dark, almost certain she was not wrong about him. What frightened her, in the quiet specific way that only true things frighten, was how much she did not want to be. 4 years of wanting nothing she couldn't provide for herself had been, in its own way, a very safe way to live. She was standing at the edge of something that was not safe. Something that required, as all true things required, the willingness to be seen, fully seen, not just the competent surface she had built and polished and presented to the world, but the part underneath it that was still, after everything, a 19-year-old girl standing in a doorway being told that the estate was gone. She was not sure she was ready. She was not sure readiness was the point. She made her decision at dawn. Not because the dawn was particularly inspiring. It was gray and damp, entirely ordinary, the kind of morning that offers no poetry whatsoever. But she had always been better at decisions made in plain light than in the theatrical dark of 2 in the morning, and what the gray dawn showed her when she looked at it honestly was simply this. She had survived everything that had happened to her. She had done it alone, and she had done it well. And she was proud of that, genuinely, unsentimentally proud, in the way that only people who have actually built something from nothing can be. But surviving alone and living fully were, she had decided sometime between the dark and the dawn, different things. And she was tired of confusing them. She came downstairs at 7 to find the entrance hall empty, and a note on the table in the Duke's handwriting, not for her, addressed to his steward about the arrangements for Monday's solicitor meeting. She was not meant to see it. She saw it anyway because she always saw things, and what it contained was a list of instructions so thorough, so carefully protective of her legal position and her independent interests, that she stood in the empty hall for a full minute reading it, and then set it back down precisely as she had found it. She went to the kitchen and asked for tea. Mrs. Baird, who missed nothing, looked at her face and then looked at the ceiling and then said, with the brisk satisfaction of a woman who has been waiting for a particular piece of weather to break, "I'll bring it to the schoolroom, shall I?" "Thank you, Mrs. Baird," Clara said. "He's in the study," Mrs. Baird added without being asked. "Has been since 6. Clara looked at her. Mrs. Baird began making tea with great concentration. "Thank you," Clara said again, and went upstairs to collect the children. She did not go to the study that morning. Or that afternoon. She taught. She corrected Thomas's geography and praised Annabelle's remarkably accurate sketch of a barn owl that had appeared outside the schoolroom window. She ate supper with the children in the nursery, and read them 3 chapters of a novel that Annabelle declared the best thing she had ever heard, and Thomas declared tolerably acceptable, which was his equivalent of the same thing. She settled them for the night. She stood in the corridor outside their rooms for a moment, listening to the house settle into its evening quiet. Then she walked to the study and knocked. "Come in," he said. He was at his desk, papers spread in front of him, but he was not writing. He was sitting very still in the way of someone who has heard a sound and is waiting to find out what it means. Clara came in and closed the door. She stood in the center of the room, not near the door, not near his desk, but in the middle on her own ground.
"I've made a decision," she said. He said nothing. He was watching her with the full, careful attention she had come to recognize as his version of holding his breath.
"The estate needs to be settled first," she said. "That is not negotiable, and I will not have it tangled up with anything else. My solicitor, my own, which I will arrange, will communicate with yours, and it will be done correctly, and when it is done, I will be in a position to make any subsequent decisions from a place of independence rather than obligation. That is important to me."
"I understand," he said. "I agree completely."
"Second," she said, "I will continue to teach Thomas and Annabelle for as long as they benefit from it, and I choose to do it. That is not subject to revision based on any change in circumstances."
"Also agreed."
Third, she paused. "I am not," she said carefully, "objecting to the general shape."
He had gone very still.
"I am saying that I would like to understand it better," she continued. "Over time, without pressure and without the estate hanging over it and without," she stopped. "Without either of us pretending that this is a simple thing, because it isn't, and I don't have any patience for pretending."
"Neither do I," he said.
"Good."
She looked at him.
He looked at her.
Something in the room had shifted, the same shift she had felt in the library, but settled now, quieter, like a thing that has found the shape it was always moving toward.
"I should tell you," he said, "that I have been sitting at this desk since 6 this morning attempting to draft a letter to you, in the event that you decided to leave."
Clara looked at the papers in front of him.
"Did you finish it?" she said.
"No."
"What did it say?"
He was quiet for a moment.
"It said that I would ensure the estate was returned regardless," he said, "and that I understood if you chose to go, and that," he stopped, "that Wrentham Manor would be considerably worse without you in it, in any capacity."
Clara looked at the fire.
"That," she said, after a moment, "is considerably more romantic than your waltz conversation."
"I've been practicing," he said, and the dry, careful warmth in his voice, the voice she had been hearing more of in the past 2 weeks, the voice that lived underneath the Duke of Wrentham and was, she suspected, significantly more interesting, made her press her lips together against something she did not try very hard to suppress.
She moved to the door.
"Good night, James," she said.
"Good night, Clara."
She paused with her hand on the frame.
"The letter," she said without turning, "don't finish it."
A silence.
"No," he said quietly, "I won't."
She went upstairs.
2 floors above the study, in the east wing room with the window overlooking the stables, Clara Ashford sat on the edge of her narrow bed and looked at the small book of botanical illustrations on the writing table, the only thing she had kept from the life before. She thought about her mother, who had believed that a woman should be able to do anything in a ballroom that a man could do. She thought her mother would have had a great deal to say about the Duke of Wrentham.
Most of it, she suspected, would have been approving.
She allowed herself, in the privacy of the East Wing, in the quiet of the evening, with no one to see it and no composure to maintain, 1 full minute of something that felt remarkably like hope. Then she blew out the candle and went to sleep. But in the morning, something was wrong. The solicitor's letter that had been on the entrance hall table was gone. Mrs. Baird's face, when Clara came downstairs, was carefully neutral in the specific way it was neutral when she was concealing something significant. And the Duke's horse was gone from the stable. He had left for London before dawn.
Without a word.
He left no note. Clara stood in the entrance hall at 7 in the morning with her tea cooling in her hand and looked at the empty table where the solicitor's letter had been and felt the particular cold of a woman who has just made herself vulnerable and is now standing in the evidence of having done so. She did not panic. She did not cry. She set her tea down on the table when a fine Mrs. Baird and asked, with complete composure, what had happened. Mrs. Baird's carefully neutral expression cracked slightly at the edges, not much, but enough. A messenger came at 4:30 this morning, Miss Ashford, from London. His Grace left within the hour. What kind of messenger? A pause, the legal kind. Clara looked at her steadily. Mrs. Baird. The housekeeper exhaled, the exhale of a woman who has been holding something, and has decided that holding it is no longer serving anyone. There's been a challenge, she said quietly, to the estate documentation. Someone, I don't know who, I only heard what the footman heard, someone has filed a counterclaim against the Ashford restitution. Clara was very still. A counterclaim, she said. Filed 3 days ago, apparently. His Grace's solicitor only learned of it yesterday evening. The messenger came to say that if it isn't addressed in person in London by the end of the week, Mrs. Baird stopped. I don't know the legal particulars, Miss Ashford. I only know that he left in a hurry and he didn't look, she paused, choosing her word. He didn't look well. Clara set her hand flat on the entrance hall table. She thought about the study, about I am not objecting to the general shape, about the unfinished letter he had promised not to finish, about the particular quality of the silence when she had said good night and meant something larger than good night, and they had both known it. She thought about a counterclaim filed 3 days ago by someone who did not want the Ashford estate returned. She thought about who, in this county, had looked away from her at the Harwick ball. Mrs. Baird, she said, who filed it? I don't. Who in this county had reason to? Who had access to the original documentation? Who knew enough about the situation to know there was something to challenge? Mrs. Baird was quiet for a long moment. Sir Edmund Graves, she said finally, has been the primary tenant of the Ashford land for 4 years. At a rate, I understand, considerably below market value. Clara looked at the window. Sir Edmund Graves, who had known her father well enough to attend his funeral, who had turned his back on her at the Harwick ball with the practiced ease of a man who has been doing something he knows, is wrong for long enough that it has stopped feeling wrong. The man who was paying almost nothing for land that was not his, that had been taken from her father under circumstances that did not bear examination, and who had apparently decided that the Duke of Rentham's inconvenient conscience was a problem requiring legal intervention. Right, Clara said. She went upstairs. She was packed in 20 minutes. Not everything. She left the botanical illustrations on the writing table, which was either a statement of intent or an act of faith, and she did not examine which. She took the leather bag, the 2 changes of dress, the hairbrush, and the folder of documents she had been quietly, methodically assembling for the past 2 weeks copies of her father's original correspondence, the letters she had saved, the records she had carried with her through 4 years of careful erasure because she had always known, with the cold instinct of someone who has been wronged, that she would need them eventually. She knocked on the schoolroom door. Thomas and Annabelle looked up from their breakfast. She came in and sat across from them at the table, which was what she always did, and looked at them both with the full attention she always gave them, which Thomas registered immediately and Annabelle registered a 1/2 second later. Something is happening, Thomas said, not a question. Yes, Clara said, I need to go to London. Annabelle put down her spoon. Her face moved through several expressions very quickly. Surprise, fear, the particular grief of a child who has lost people before and recognizes the early shape of it. For how long, she said. I don't know yet, Clara said honestly, but I want you to listen to me carefully, both of you. She looked at Thomas, then at Annabelle. I am not leaving because I want to. I am leaving because something needs to be dealt with, and I am the only person who can deal with it. Do you understand the difference?" Thomas nodded. He understood better than most adults, she thought, the difference between chosen departure and necessary departure. He had been paying attention to the difference his whole life. Annabelle's lower lip was doing something precarious. "Will you come back?" she said. Clara looked at her. She thought about the general shape, about the botanical illustrations on the writing table, about the unfinished letter, about a man who had ridden toward London in the dark without a word because something was threatening to undo the one thing he had been trying to do right for 3 years. "Yes," she said, with a certainty that surprised her with its completeness. "I will come back." Annabelle studied her face for a long moment, the searching, unguarded scrutiny of a 6-year-old who has not yet learned to pretend she believes things she doesn't. Then she nodded. "All right," she said, and picked up her spoon again with the resolute air of someone who has made a decision to trust and intends to honor it. Thomas said nothing, but as Clara stood to leave, he reached across the table and put his hand briefly, formally, over hers, the same gesture he had made in the corridor before the ball, the 9-year-old gravity of it entirely unchanged. "Safe travels, Miss Ashford," he said. Clara pressed her hand over his for one moment. Then she picked up her bag and went downstairs. Mrs. Baird was waiting in the entrance hall with a package wrapped in brown paper. "Provisions," she said before Clara could speak. "It's a long journey and the coaching in at Brentwood has been unreliable since the summer." Clara looked at her. Mrs. Baird looked at the wall. "The early coach from the village stops at the crossroads at 8:30, Mrs. Baird said. "If you leave now, you'll make it." "Mrs. Baird," Clara said. "Yes, Miss Ashford." "Thank you," she said, "for everything since the first day." Mrs. Baird's expression did something complicated and then resolved into its most neutral configuration. "The fire in your room will be lit when you return," she said. "I'll see to it myself." Clara picked up her bag. She walked out the front door, down the stone steps, and onto the drive in the cool morning air. The grounds were beautiful in the early light, the fallen leaves gilded, the sky beginning to clear, the long avenue of beeches that lined the drive casting thin shadows across the gravel. She had arrived here in a borrowed carriage, through the servant's entrance in the morning mist. She left through the front door, on her own in the early light, carrying everything she needed. It was, she thought, better. London in October was a different creature from the county. Louder, faster, more indifferent. A city that moved with the self-absorbed energy of a place that has too much happening to pay attention to any of it, which was, Clara had always found, both its greatest flaw and its most useful quality. No one looked at her on the streets of London. No one turned away. She arrived at 4:30 in the afternoon, found a respectable lodging house in a quiet street near Bloomsbury that she had used once before. The landlady remembered her, which was either luck or a testament to the impression she left, and showed her to a clean, warm room without excessive comment. She changed her dress. She opened her folder of documents on the small writing table. And then she sat down and began to work. She had known when she assembled the folder that she might need it. She had told herself it was precaution, the habit of a careful woman who had learned that hope was most useful when accompanied by preparation. What she had not told herself, because she had not been ready to admit it, was that she had assembled it for exactly this moment. That some part of her, the part that had grown up watching her father navigate impossible situations with insufficient information, had known from the beginning that the path back to what was hers was not going to be clean or simple or free of people who preferred things stay as they were. Sir Edmund Graves had been the primary tenant for 4 years. He had filed a counterclaim. He had, in all probability, friends at the relevant offices and a solicitor who specialized in exactly the kind of delay that wore people down until they surrendered. Clara had something different. She had the original correspondence between her father and the previous Duke. She had the loan agreement, which she had copied with meticulous care from memory after reading it in the Duke's study, every clause, every condition, every margin note. She had 2 letters from her father's solicitor, written in the weeks before his death, expressing concerns about the terms of the agreement that had never been formally addressed. And she had, at the bottom of the folder, a document she had obtained 3 weeks before coming to Wrentham, obtained quietly, through a contact from her former life who still owed her father a considerable debt of gratitude, that established, in plain and unambiguous legal language, that the rate Sir Edmund Graves had been paying for 4 years of tenancy on the Ashford land was not merely below market value. It was below the minimum stipulated in the original tenancy agreement. He had been underpaying, provably, for 4 years, which meant that any counterclaim he filed would be subject to an immediate cross-examination of his own compliance with the agreement he was citing. Clara sat at the small writing table in the Bloomsbury lodging house and looked at her documents and felt, for the first time in 4 years, not like a woman fighting to recover something, but like a woman who has already won and is simply completing the paperwork. She wrote 3 letters. One to her new solicitor, whose name she had obtained from Lady Portia, through Mrs. Baird, through a roundabout chain of communication that she suspected Lady Portia had arranged specifically for this eventuality, with instructions and the relevant documents enclosed. One to the office that had received Sir Edmund's counterclaim, formally notifying them of her legal representation and requesting a copy of the filing. And one that she addressed, after a moment's thought, simply to J. Calloway, Duke of Wrentham, asterisk care of his London address, which she knew because it was on the letterhead of every document she had read. This one she wrote last, and it was the shortest. I have arrived. The documents are in order. My solicitor will contact yours by Wednesday morning. Sir Edmund Graves has been underpaying his tenancy for 4 years. I have proof. Your solicitor will want to know this before Thursday's meeting. Do not attempt to handle this on my behalf. I am handling it. CA asterisk. P.S. The children are well. Thomas is worried about you. He won't say so, but he is. She sealed it and sent it with the lodging house boy before she could revise it, because she had learned in the past 2 weeks that revision was her enemy, that the first true version of a thing was always more honest than the corrected one. Then she ate the provisions Mrs. Baird had packed, which turned out to be considerably more substantial than anticipated and included, somewhat improbably, a small portion of the excellent shortbread that was apparently Mrs. Baird's private specialty and not, under normal circumstances, shared. Clara ate it by the window, watching the London street below, and thought about Wrentham Manor in the evening light, and the East Wing room, and the botanical illustrations she had left on the writing table. She thought about the general shape of things. Then she went to bed and slept, for the first time in 2 weeks, without waking. The meeting was on Thursday. Clara arrived 11 minutes early, which was her standard early enough to establish presence, late enough not to appear anxious. She wore the midnight blue dress because it was her best and because she had decided, somewhere between Bloomsbury and the solicitor's offices in Gray's Inn, that she was done defaulting to Gray. Her solicitor, a small, precise man named Mr. Fellows who came with Lady Portia's recommendation, and immediately gave the impression of a man who had spent 40 years winning arguments that other people had assumed were already lost, met her in the anteroom, and reviewed her documents with the focused attention of someone who recognizes ammunition when he sees it. "The underpayment," he said, looking up from the tenancy document. "Where did you obtain this?"
"Carefully," Clara said.
He looked at her over his spectacles.
"It's entirely legal," she said.
"It was obtained by a former associate of my father's who had legitimate access. I can provide the full account if required."
Mr. Fellows looked back at the document.
"It won't be required," he said, with the satisfied tone of a man who has just been handed exactly what he needed. "Sir Edmund's entire counterclaim rests on the validity of the existing tenancy arrangement. If that arrangement has been in breach..."
"His claim collapses," Clara said.
"His claim," Mr. Fellows said with legal precision, "becomes significantly complicated." He set the document down and looked at her.
"You've done a great deal of preparation for a governess, Miss Ashford."
"I'm a baron's daughter," Clara said. "I was a governess in the interim."
Mr. Fellows almost smiled.
"Quite so," he said.
She did not see the Duke until the meeting had been underway for 20 minutes.
The conference room was large, formal, paneled in dark wood, and contained, around its long table, a collection of solicitors and legal representatives who had the collective energy of men anticipating a complicated afternoon. Sir Edmund's solicitor, a florid man named Carver who had the specific confidence of someone accustomed to winning through obstruction rather than merit, was already speaking when Clara arrived with Mr. Fellows, and he continued speaking for 30 seconds after she sat down, which she interpreted as either obliviousness or a deliberate assertion of dominance, and treated accordingly, which was to say she ignored it entirely and arranged her documents in front of her.
She heard the door open.
She did not look up. She knew the sound of his step, had learned it in the corridors of Wrentham Manor, the particular rhythm of a man who moved through spaces as though they belonged to him, which they generally did. She heard it cross the room, stop at the chair diagonally across from her, and then stop.
She looked up.
He was looking at her with an expression she had not seen before, not the managed composure, not the careful attention, not even the unguarded warmth of the library evening. Something rawer than any of those. Something that looked unmistakably like relief. She held his gaze for exactly 1 second. Then she looked back at her documents.
Mr. Carver had stopped speaking.
The room was very quiet.
"Gentlemen," said Mr. Fellows into the silence, with the pleasant efficiency of a man who has been waiting for his moment, "perhaps we should begin."
It took 2 hours. Not because Clara's case was weak. It was not weak. It was devastatingly thorough, and Mr. Fellows deployed it with the methodical precision of a man who understood that the best legal arguments did not announce themselves, but accumulated quietly, until the other side looked up and discovered they were surrounded.
It took 2 hours because Sir Edmund's solicitor was experienced enough to fight for every inch of ground, and because legal processes have their own rhythms that cannot be hurried regardless of how clear the outcome is, and because there was a period somewhere in the middle of the second hour where several documents had to be reviewed and cross-referenced and verified, during which the room had the particular suspended quality of a moment waiting to resolve itself. During this period, Clara looked up once.
The Duke was watching her.
He had said almost nothing in 2 hours. His own solicitor had spoken for him on the points that required his direct involvement, which was correct and appropriate. But she suspected that even if it had not been correct and appropriate, he would have remained largely silent, because he had understood from her letter what she needed, which was to do this herself, and he had respected it completely. He was doing it now. Sitting across the long table, watching her handle a legal challenge to her own future with the same composure she had brought to a cold room and an unwelcoming house and a 3-mile walk through a rainstorm, and his expression contained something that she could read now,
could read with the confidence of someone who has been paying attention, as not merely admiration, as something considerably more than admiration. Something that had been building, she understood, since the moment she had arrived before him at the Crown, an anchor with her tea and her book and her complete, infuriating composure. She looked back at her documents. Mr. Fellows, at her side, was presenting the tenancy underpayment evidence. Mr. Carver, across the table, had gone the particular color of a man who has just understood that the ground beneath him has been less solid than he believed. Sir Edmund Graves, beside his solicitor, was looking at the table in front of him with the expression of a man who has spent 4 years looking away, and is now discovering that this strategy has a limited useful life. At 4:20, Mr. Carver requested a brief recess. At 4:25, he returned and indicated that his client was prepared to withdraw the counterclaim. At 4:30, the relevant documents were signed. At 5:20, Clara Ashford walked out of the solicitor's offices in Gray's Inn into the cool October evening air as the legal owner of her family's estate, its 4 years of accrued income, and a tenancy arrangement that would be renegotiated at market rate within 30 days. She stood on the pavement and breathed. The city moved around her, indifferent busy, entirely unaware that anything had happened. She heard the door behind her. She turned. He stood on the steps, coat on, hat in hand, looking at her with the expression she had stopped trying to manage her response to somewhere around the second hour of the meeting, when he had sat across a long table and understood exactly what she needed and given it to her without being asked. "Congratulations," he said. "Thank you," she said. "Your solicitor's information about the underpayment timeline was helpful. Tell him so." "He'll be pleased." A pause. "My solicitor was the one who found it, actually, 3 weeks ago. He didn't tell me until yesterday because he was trying to determine if it was sufficient." He paused again. "I was going to tell you on Monday, before the counterclaim arrived." Clara looked at him. "You were already building the case," she said. "You were already building the case," he said. "I was supplementing it. There's a difference." He looked at her with the full, careful attention that was simply, she had accepted, the way he looked at her. "Mr. Fellows told me what you brought. He said he'd rarely seen a better prepared client." "Mr. Fellows is a sensible man," Clara said. "He is. My mother chose him specifically." He paused. "I'm beginning to suspect my mother is considerably more strategically capable than I have previously given her credit for." "You should tell her that," Clara said. "She'd appreciate it." A silence. The October evening was cooling around them, the sky above the Grays in rooftops going from gold to the particular deep blue of early dusk, and the city was shifting into its evening register, louder and warmer and less formal than the day. "I didn't handle this correctly," he said. Clara looked at him. The meeting seemed. Not the meeting, before the meeting. He was looking at her directly, the way he did when he had decided something and had stopped managing how it appeared. "I left without a word. I had your letter, the messenger's letter, and I left without coming to tell you myself, without explaining, without..." He stopped. "It was the wrong choice. I knew it when I made it, and I made it anyway, because I thought if I stopped to speak to you I would be late for the coach, and the counterclaim would succeed, and the estate would be..." He stopped again. "That is the explanation. It is not an excuse." Clara looked at him for a long moment. "You rode to London before dawn," she said, "to stop a counterclaim against an estate that you were in the process of returning to someone who had not yet decided what she thought of you." He said nothing. "James," she said, "I arrived in London 4 hours after you did, and I've already resolved it." "A beat." "I'm aware," he said. "And you left before dawn because you were afraid that if you lost this, you would lose..." She stopped herself. That is also an explanation, not an excuse.
He looked at her. She looked at him. The city moved around them with its cheerful, indifferent noise, and neither of them moved, standing on the pavement outside the Grays in solicitors' offices in the early evening of an October Thursday, looking at each other with the particular attention of two people who have been circling the same truth for long enough that they have both become tired of circling.
"I would like to ask you something," he said.
"Ask."
"Come back to Wrentham." "I was already planning to come back to Wrentham." As he stopped, looked at his hat, looked back at her, as more than a governess. "As I am attempting," he said, with the slightly pained expression of a man who is articulate in every context except this one, "to ask you to."
"James," Clara said.
"Yes."
"Are you asking me to marry you?"
A pause.
"I'm attempting to," he said. "I'm finding it more difficult than anticipated."
"That's because you keep stopping in the middle of sentences," she said. "Ask the sentence."
He looked at her. Something in his face settled, the particular settling of a man who has decided to simply be exactly where he is without managing it.
"Clara Ashford," he said, "will you marry me?"
The city went on around them. A carriage passed. Someone laughed somewhere down the street. The sky had gone fully blue now, deep and clear, the first stars beginning to appear above the rooftops. Clara looked at him. She thought about the general shape of things. She thought about arriving before him at the Crown and Anchor, about a 9-year-old boy offering his arm in a corridor, about a 6-year-old girl saying you look like a queen with absolute certainty, about a botanical illustration book left on a writing table in an East Wing room as an act of faith. She thought about 4 years of building something from nothing, and about the fact that building from nothing was a skill, not a sentence, and that the woman who had done it was not someone who needed to stop, just someone who might, finally, have somewhere permanent to build toward.
"Yes," she said, "with conditions."
"Name them," he said immediately.
"The teaching continues. The estate is managed independently. I keep my own solicitor."
"Agreed, agreed, and obviously agreed."
"And," she said, "if you ever again ride to London before dawn without leaving a note, I will arrive there before you and be deeply unbothered by it, and you will find that significantly more uncomfortable than an argument." The corner of his mouth moved, not the almost smile she had been cataloging for weeks, but the actual one, full and unguarded and entirely unmanaged, transforming his face into something that looked, suddenly, like the person that had been living underneath the Duke of Wrentham all along.
"That," he said, "is the most credible threat I have ever received."
"Good," Clara said, "then we understand each other."
He stepped forward. She did not step back.
He took her hand, properly, correctly, in the middle of a London street in October, with the city moving all around them and no one paying the slightest attention, and looked at her with an expression that required no interpretation, no cataloging, no careful reading of the gap between what was shown and what was felt.
"We understand each other," he said.
Clara looked at their hands.
Then she looked at him.
"Wrentham Manor," she said. "How long is the drive from here?"
4 hours, perhaps 3.5 if we leave early.
"Then we should leave early," she said. "The children will be impossible by morning if they haven't had word.
Mrs. Baird will have told them something."
"Mrs. Baird will have told them nothing and been entirely transparent about it," Clara said. "Which is worse?"
He laughed, a real one, unguarded and warm, the laugh of a man who has not laughed like that in a very long time and is discovering that it is not as difficult as he remembered.
Clara looked at him laughing and felt something in her chest that she did not try to name or contain or be sensible about.
She had been sensible for 4 years.
She could afford, she decided,
to be something else for a moment.
They left London the following morning at 6:30. The Duke had arranged a carriage, a good one, warm and well-sprung, with blankets and provisions that Clara suspected Mrs. Baird had somehow orchestrated from a distance through a chain of communication she preferred not to examine. Clara slept for the first hour, which she had not intended and did not apologize for, because 4 days of London solicitors and lodging houses and the sustained effort of winning something important had, it turned out, used a great deal of energy, and the carriage was warm, and the road was smooth. And there was, for the first time in a very long time, nowhere she needed to be that she was not already going. When she woke, it was to the particular gray-gold light of an English morning over open fields, and the Duke sitting across from her with a book open in his lap that he was not reading. He was looking out the window. "How long until Wrentham?" she said. "An hour," he said without turning, "perhaps less." "You're not reading," she said. "No," he agreed. "What are you thinking about?" He turned then and looked at her with the expression she had stopped trying to manage her response to, the full, unmanaged, entirely legible expression of a man who had spent 3 years looking for something, and was sitting across from it in a carriage an hour from home. "Nothing in particular," he said, "everything in general." Clara looked at the fields going past the window. "Yes," she said, "me too." They did not speak again for the rest of the journey, which was not silence in the empty sense, but silence in the full sense. The kind that belongs to people who have said what needed to be said and are content, for the moment, simply to be moving in the same direction. Wrentham Manor appeared through the carriage window at 9:20. Gray stone, ivy-strangled window frames, chimneys exhaling thin white smoke into a sky that had, uncharacteristically, decided to be blue. The front door opened before the carriage had fully stopped. Annabel came down the steps at a speed that suggested she had been watching the drive from the schoolroom window for some time, and had descended the moment she saw the carriage, abandoning whatever composure Mrs. Baird had attempted to instill in her waiting. Thomas followed at a more measured pace, with his hands clasped behind his back and his face arranged into a careful neutrality that was betrayed entirely by the speed at which he was walking. Clara stepped out of the carriage. Annabel hit her at approximately knee height, with the force of a small, determined person who has decided that dignity is entirely secondary to relief. "You came back," Annabel said into Clara's coat. "I told you I would," Clara said, and put her arms around her. Thomas stopped 2 feet away and looked at her with the searching, specific attention of someone who is checking that what they hoped for is actually what they are seeing. Clara looked back at him. She nodded once. Something in Thomas's face settled, the quiet, internal settling of a child who has been holding his breath and has just remembered how to stop. "Welcome back, Miss Ashford," he said. "Thank you, Thomas," she said. Behind her, she heard the Duke say something to Mrs. Baird, low and brief. She heard Mrs. Baird respond with the particular tone she used when she was pleased about something and was committed to not showing it. She heard from somewhere inside the house the sound of a fire already lit. She looked up at Wrentham Manor, the gray stone, the ivy, the chimneys, the window of the east wing room where she had left a book of botanical illustrations on the writing table as an act of faith. She had arrived at this house through the servant's entrance, in the morning mist, with a worn leather bag and a secret that could have brought the estate to its knees. She was arriving now through the front door, in the morning light, with the estate legally restored, and a future that had, against every reasonable expectation, arranged itself into a shape she had not dared to plan for. Annabel had not let go of her coat. "Come inside," said the Duke behind her,
Mrs. Baird has made breakfast.
Mrs. Baird always makes breakfast, Clara said.
Today she made the good kind, he said. She made shortbread.
Clara looked at him over Annabelle's head.
He was watching her with the expression she had stopped cataloging and started simply receiving. The way one receives good weather, or morning light, or the specific warmth of a room that has been expecting you.
Well then, she said.
She took Annabelle's hand.
She walked through the front door of Wrentham Manor.
She did not look back.
She didn't need to.
He was right behind her.
1 year later, the schoolroom at Wrentham Manor had acquired, over the course of 12 months, several new features.
A second bookshelf, taller than the first, filled with natural history texts and political histories, and a complete set of botanical illustrations that Thomas had selected himself from a London bookseller's catalog, with the focused seriousness of a 10-year-old who has opinions and the vocabulary to defend them.
A large globe, positioned near the window, that Annabelle rotated approximately 40 times a day, and could now locate any country on with her eyes closed, a skill she demonstrated to visitors with the particular satisfaction of someone who knows they are impressive and has decided not to be modest about it.
And a small desk in the corner, not the teacher's desk, but a second one, placed at right angles to it, where the Duchess of Wrentham sat on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, working through correspondence, reviewing tenancy documents from the Ashford estate, and occasionally, when the children were engaged enough not to notice, looking up from her papers with the expression of a woman who has not yet entirely accustomed herself to being happy and finds the experience worth paying attention to.
On a Tuesday in late October, Thomas looked up from his geography and said, without preamble, "How did you get to the village before Father that day? In the rain?"
Clara did not look up from her correspondence.
"I took Fenwick's field," she said, "and the drainage ditch to the old mill, and the river path from there.
Father says he's asked the coachman. The coachman says it still would have taken longer than 20 minutes on foot."
"The coachman," Clara said, "is not accounting for pace."
Thomas considered this. "What pace?"
"The pace," Clara said, "of someone who has been told she cannot do something."
Thomas was quiet for a moment. Then he nodded, with the gravity of someone filing this information away for future reference.
Annabelle, who had been listening with the whole body attention she brought to anything she found interesting, looked up from the globe.
"I'm going to walk everywhere very fast," she announced. "When I'm older, so I always arrive first."
"An excellent strategy," Clara said.
The door opened. The Duke came in without knocking, which was simply what he did now, had done since approximately the third week after their return from London, when the habit of checking in on the schoolroom had become less occasional and more structural, woven into the rhythm of his afternoons, the way certain things weave themselves in when they are where they belong.
He looked at the children. He looked at Clara.
"Thomas," he said, "Annabelle."
"Father," said Thomas.
"We're learning about pace," Annabelle said.
The Duke looked at his wife.
Clara looked at her correspondence.
"Are you?" he said.
"Miss Ashe," Annabelle stopped, reconsidered. She still occasionally forgot.
"Mama says if someone tells you that you can't do something, you go faster."
The Duke was quiet for a moment.
"That," he said, "is the most accurate thing I have heard all week."
He crossed to the second desk in the corner. He set a letter down beside Clara's correspondence, the weekly report from the Ashford estate manager, which he had taken to collecting from the entrance hall on his way through, a small courtesy so habitual by now that neither of them mentioned it.
He did not leave immediately.
He stood for a moment beside the desk.
Clara looked up.
He was looking at her with the expression she had long since stopped trying to decode, and had simply accepted as the language he used for things he did not have other words for, the full, private, entirely unmanaged expression of a man who knows exactly where he is and finds it, against all prior expectation, sufficient. More than sufficient. She held his gaze for one moment. Then she looked back at her correspondence. He went to the window, checked the sky for weather in the habitual way of a man who managed land, and then went out again, back to his afternoon, back to his estate, back to the life that had, 12 months ago, rearranged itself around a woman who had arrived through the servant's entrance in the morning mist and had not, it turned out, left any room in it for things to be the way they were before. That evening at supper, Annabel asked, as she had asked approximately once a month for the past year, for the complete story of the rain. Thomas said, as he always did, that they had heard it before. Annabel said, as she always did, that she wanted to hear it again. The Duke looked at Clara across the table. Clara looked at him. "You start," she said. "You tell it better," he said. "You were there first," she said. "You arrived before I did," he said, "as usual." Annabel looked between them with the bright, patient attention of a 7-year-old, who has learned that the best thing about this particular story is not the ending but the moment just before the ending, when both of them look at each other like that and forget briefly that anyone else is in the room. "Tell it," Annabel said. Clara looked at her daughter. She smiled. "It was raining," she said, "and your father sent me away without a carriage." "And," said Annabel. "And," said Clara, "I arrived before he did." "And," said Annabel. Clara looked at the Duke. The Duke looked at Clara. "And," he said quietly, across the supper table, in the warm light of Wrentham Manor on an October evening, with the fire going and the children listening, and the whole long year of it settled around them like something built to last. "She hasn't stopped arriving first since. Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories."